Hey everyone, I'm Dan Kortler, the host of TED Climate. Each episode, we unpack the problems and solutions of climate change. This season of the show, we're getting into some big ideas that make us optimistic about the future, like meat grown from cells and leather made from mushrooms. And the best part? We look at how building a greener future can be an upgrade instead of a sacrifice. Find and follow TED Climate wherever you're listening to this.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hi, I'm Laura Lynch, and with spring finally here, we're revisiting some of our favorite stories over the past year, stories about climate solutions based in nature. What? Wait a second, Catherine. What's that?
Isn't that what you were asking for? It's the sound of an explosion from butane. And Laura, I went down a real internet rabbit hole to find it. Nobody was hurt, don't worry, but I just have to say to listeners, do not try this at home.
Don't. I remember asking you for it. I just wasn't expecting it right now. Hey, everyone out there, that is Catherine. She is our senior producer.
Hello, over on the other side of the glass. So, Laura, why did you want that sound anyway?
Because I'm about to tell a story about a brand new experiment that has fused ancient indigenous knowledge along with modern science, along with, wait for it, chairs from IKEA.
Okay.
And a butane torch.
Okay.
But actually, the butane ended up being ditched because it exploded. So the field scientist decided to switch to propane.
Okay, I am interested. I am a little bit confused. So can we just back up to the basics? I'm Catherine Rolfson. You're Laura Lynch. This is What on Earth, where we bring you a world of climate solutions. Hey, I never get to say that part.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'm going to say the rest of it. Today's episode actually isn't about butane explosions. That was just a bit of a tease. It's actually all about gardens as climate solutions, from the beach to your own backyard. And this first story is a solution from the past that's actually found new traction in today's warming world. So we're going to start on a beach on one of many small Gulf islands off the coast of BC, Russell Island, close to its much better known neighbor, Salt Spring. And it's where a collaborative effort among Coast Salish nations is having a big impact.
I'm Ken Thomas from Penalika Tribe. My traditional name is Sumpkinam, so fish and wildlife person for Penalika Tribe.
Ken Thomas got up very early on this showery morning to join me on the beach to show me the centuries-old ways of his people, the ingenious design they built to ensure a reliable supply of seafood, kind of like a pantry. Right now, he's raking the sand, tilling it, he says, using farming terms, keeping it from becoming, as he says, hard and dormant. All of this started a few years ago when the elders directed him and others to pick up large rocks from higher up the beach and place them piled one on top of the other to form a low seawall close to the low tide line.
At first it was like, okay, yeah, I'll go move rocks, okay, whatever. So we come out, we moved rocks, and then it really touched me in a way that I can't explain, really. We had so many different thoughts and different stories coming from our elders. We had our elders, you know, watching. Every time I moved a rock and placed it on the wall, I was like, wow, my ancestors touched these rocks, and here I am putting it back, restoring it back to its what it was meant for. It makes me feel like I'm in awe.
I'm curious to know, when you were a child, was there talk about these gardens? Was it something that elders would tell you about back then?
To this day, you still hear our elders say, when the tide's out, the table's set, go get your food.
The wall that creates that table runs the length of the beach, about 750 meters or so, and it's roughly a meter and a half tall. And because of it, the ocean water recedes slowly as the tide goes out, maintaining a cool, wet environment until the tide comes back in. And that makes the beach a welcoming shelter for all sorts of shellfish.
So it's kind of like tilling the soil on a farm, I guess.
Exactly. That's what it is. You know, our ancestors were building these rock walls to contain the shellfish seed. as the tide drops, the larvae are in the water column, and then the water goes down and they get caught up in these pools created by the walls. And it just benefits the beach to have this to keep food sources in here, because sometimes you get Dungeness crabs coming in here, and families would go by all these different beaches and harvest their food for their journeys wherever they're going, come in and dry clams and move on, and barter and trade somewhere down the line where somebody hasn't been out for a while. So these areas are really important to our people.
It's really amazing to see it. Technology, so to speak, that's thought to be about 4,000 years old. These so-called clam gardens are being restored up and down the coast. Now Ken and other members of First Nations here are working with researchers from Simon Fraser University in Vancouver. What is your role in the research that's going on here?
Moving rocks.
Something tells me you're downplaying things a little bit. Ken is being modest. He's directly involved in the work, ensuring Indigenous knowledge and practices are respected as young scientists investigate whether these gardens can help protect clams from extreme heat.
Yeah, we created these little saunas for the clams.
That's Emily Spencer. She's a master's student in the Coastal Marine Ecology and Conservation Lab at SFU. This is her thesis project, recreating the conditions of the heat dome 2 years ago that killed hundreds of people and billions of sea creatures. She's trying to find out if these traditional clam gardens can help protect marine life against future episodes of extreme heat, sure to come as the earth warms. On the beach, she and the team did that by building tents, or saunas as she said, using some pretty unscientific stuff.
Then we added heat to half of them. So we created these heat dome structures using propane heaters and IKEA chairs.
Yep, chairs from IKEA to create the structure, inflammable sheets to make the tents, and propane to provide the heat. And in figuring out how to do all of this, Emily admits to a rather explosive discovery.
Before we got there, we had experimented with some butane canisters, and unfortunately, one blew up.
Oh, God.
Luckily, everyone was safe.
Everyone, including the clams, since this happened before the actual experiment was carried out. So here's what Emily and the team did on the beach. At low tide, they erected a series of these small tents with the clams inside each of them so they could keep track of the temperature. They did this for 5 days straight, replicating the length of the actual heat dome. And it was a mad scramble to take down the tents every time the tide came back in.
It sure was. We had lots of help and we had canoes, but it was a lot of gear and a lot of work.
Then all the clams were scooped up and taken to labs for analysis. Compared to clams on normal beaches without the cooling effect of the clam gardens, what did she discover?
So we've found that it seems like the clam gardens are cooler even where we added the heat. Yeah, and the other thing that we've found is, you know, we've been looking at the ecophysiology of the clams on the clam gardens because we're interested in how heat impacts their stress levels. So during the heat wave, you know, we saw mass die-offs of clams, but we also maybe what we weren't able to see with our eyes was the impacts on like growth rates and reproduction and pathogen infections. But with genomic methods, we're able to study that and see that response in the clams. So that's what we're doing with the Center for Shellfish Research at Vancouver Island University. We're looking at those impacts on clam stress.
That cooling effect points to the gardens as more than a way to create and maintain a food source. It suggests they may also be a climate change adaptation strategy. Emily's supervisor, SFU professor and marine ecologist Ann Solomon is here on the beach too. And as we start talking, the rain begins to fall on us.
Well, I think the bigger picture here is that you're looking at a climate solution. And we're desperately looking around the world for climate solutions. And here's one that is at least 4,000 years old. And you just heard from Ken perfectly how it works. It's a very simple process So I'm very optimistic about the future when I see examples like this. I think that's one of the bigger pictures. And these clam gardens, they're not alone in their ingenuity. They're examples of sea gardens across the Pacific made by people thousands of years ago that carefully observed nature. They tinkered with it, they experimented with it, which is one reason I think it was second nature for Ken to consider actually our experiment as a valid thing to do, as something we ought to do. Because in the past, people experimented with systems and they figured out what can they do to stabilize climate extremes. We have had climate extremes in the past, and this is just an amazing, ingenious, yet simple method that provides a really kind of optimistic view of our future in coping with climate change.
For Ken Thomas, greenlighting the experiment was a no-brainer. If it helps the clam survive and thrive, it's worth it.
Just last night, we had a nice pod of steamers, manila clams and little necks. So, you know, we still utilize it, and we still love it, and we want it around forever. So,
as for the findings, Ken kind of already knew ancient knowledge had the answer.
Is it also, in a way, a vindication, an affirmation, a confirmation that what your people have done down the centuries is science in its own right, that was always there but maybe not respected as much?
I feel, yeah, for sure. I think, you know, see that clam squirting right there?
Yeah.
You know, you look at the walls, it retains the water, so when it's hot out, the water is slower to drain. So when the temperature is really hot out, the beach stays cool. And so by the time the water drains out of here, the tide's coming right back up. So the survival rate is going to be better than on a normal flat beach.
And Solomon is thrilled with this collaboration, seeing it as a way forward.
So yeah. The rock wall is the future. It's not the past.
Yeah, right. Well said. That's exactly right.
What has the experience been like for you working together with First Nations when they're leading these projects?
You know, honestly, it's what gets me up in the morning and excites me to no end, and to see, you know, all of the students, the generation now, this generation of undergraduate and graduate students, they see this, they recognize this. There's a huge appetite and willingness and interest in engaging with and learning from knowledge holders that have been interacting with these places for millennia. And I just see this next generation of scientists considering these data sources, these practices, and these kinds of engaged research initiatives as the future.
So there. And if you want to know whether I was having fun on this reporting mission, here's a clue for you. A clam squirted suddenly. And that means it was expelling water as it was filtering out food for itself on the beach. Now, I've seen that many times growing up on the coast and digging for clams. I only wish that this time I'd been able to harvest some for myself. Now, just to let you know, Emily's research project is part of her master's thesis, which she's expecting to defend later this year, and it will be submitted for peer review and publication after that. All right, we've now left the rainy beach. Instead, I am sitting on a beautiful sun-splashed rooftop. I'm on another field trip here to a different kind of garden.
Yeah, that's right, Laura. We're at the Vancouver Public Library.
That's what on Earth producer Molly Siegel.
Hi.
Hi, not just any garden. It is the roof garden at the Vancouver Public Library. A really lovely, quiet bit of a sanctuary here. I can look and see carnations, beautiful heather is growing. I can see some butterflies moving around, trees, greenery, and of course people enjoying the beautiful weather here, reading and just taking it all in.
Yeah, it sure beats the office on a day like today.
Considering the office is just across the street.
Yeah, we could bring our computers here. But joking aside, we're actually here for a reason. And that's because we heard from our listeners with questions about gardens and yards and plants and pollinators. And I have some of those questions here, Laura. Have some emails printed out.
Oh, you're using the old way of doing it, printing them out.
Yes. Can I read some to you?
Yeah, go ahead.
So we heard from Chloe Fott in Victoria. This is part of what she wrote. Quote, "As a homeowner in a suburban neighborhood with a decent-sized lot, I am always wondering about how I should be caring for this small green space in the best way possible for the planet that will help my community mitigate climate change impacts and increase the resiliency of other species and ourselves. I have questions about plantings and yard care, and even our perceptions of what these spaces should be like. As I move around these spaces observing the manicured lawns with a single rhododendron, I know that we could be doing better for biodiversity by increasing diversity. Is this also a way to build resiliency?"
Chloe, lots of good questions there about lawns, climate, and biodiversity, and some things I think we're going to be looking into.
Yeah, we're going to get some answers, and those are all really good questions. But first, Laura, I have a second email to read you. Kat Vanderlinden in Ottawa wrote to us. She says, quote, "My local eco-groups are constantly arguing about dandelions and native bees. The big questions are, is the pollen from dandelions actively bad for them? And do dandelions substantially distract bees from more nutritious pollen sources like native trees and plants? I find this debate very unfortunate because No Mow May was pushed for a few years, and I think it's discouraging for eco-conscious people to be told they're endangering native bees by allowing dandelions to grow on their lawns."
Okay, there's one thing in there that tripped me up. What is No Mow May? It sounds like somebody's name.
Yeah, I know. It was new to me too. Okay, No Mow May just refers to this movement for people to stop mowing their lawns for the month of May, just for the month of May, and to let whatever grows there grow there. And the idea is that it's supposed to be good for pollinators like bees, but as we will find out, the truth here in North America is a little more complicated than that.
All right. Well, we've got a couple of guests joining us that are going to help answer the questions about gardens and backyards.
My name's Lorraine Johnson, and I write books about native plant gardening and habitat to support pollinators.
My name is Sheila Cola. I'm an associate professor in the Faculty of Environmental and Urban Change at York University in Toronto.
We wrote a book together called A Garden for the Rusty Patched Bumblebee, Creating Habitat for Native Pollinators.
And there you are, Lorraine Johnson and Sheila Cola. Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Let's start with our listener Kat's question about No Mow May and bees. Sheila, what is your take on No Mow May?
Wow, you have some great questions coming in, some really smart listeners. I do have some issues with the whole No Mow May movement. It sort of started in the UK and in Europe, and I don't really think it's completely applicable to North America. And one of the reasons is dandelions are one of the main things that it sort of promotes.
I think you referred to it as kind of junk food, didn't you?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to, put labels on different types of flowers, but it is a really low protein source. And there was a study that showed that bumblebee queens that were fed dandelion pollen and prunus pollen and willow pollen for the dandelion pollen, they actually ended up eating their own eggs because they were so protein deprived. And the other thing about dandelions is it's a really successful invader. It disrupts the pollination systems of plants that are growing beside it. The pollen, if it's deposited on another plant, can actually disrupt that plant from being pollinated. So there's all sorts of reasons why I'm a little bit leery of programs that talk about promoting non-native plant species to protect native pollinators. There's a little bit of a disconnect there.
Okay. Lorraine, when you hear from people who get excited about No Mow May, I'm wondering how you help channel that desire to help biodiversity.
Yeah, I think it's so important to kind of harness the energy that and the good intentions of people and direct it towards actually creating very meaningful habitat. And the way to do that is by planting native plants and then maintaining a space in certain ways that will promote biodiversity and support insects and other creatures. So, for example, leaving the leaves or leaving plant stalks. These are maintenance techniques that can also really support the native pollinators.
And Lorraine, we're going to get back into that question of native plants and what kinds a little later on. But I just wanted to ask you, our listener, Chloe, she asked about the look of an overgrown lawn. I'm wondering if the idea of non-mome could help people get used to that idea of a different type of yard.
People are afraid of habitat gardens in some ways for aesthetic reasons. They think, oh, they're going to look messy. People are going to complain. Now, of course, you can create a habitat garden with native plants in a very formal looking style or design. But it's true that when you leave plants, stalks standing over the winter, or you leave the dead leaves, you know, it's not necessarily the most common look in a garden yet. Hopefully we'll get to the place where that is common and accepted and just what's done. But for now, it does look a little bit different. So one of the values of non-mome is that it kind of normalizes a different aesthetic, but it only does that for 1 month. What we need is habitat gardens throughout the growing season, not just for 1 month.
I've been learning so much through looking at what you've written about the subject, both of you, things I never thought about before. But when people talk about biodiversity, I don't know that backyards and city gardens always come to mind. So Sheila, I'm wondering why our personal and shared green spaces in cities are part of how we adapt to climate change.
Yeah, it's so important. I think people think of cities and they think of concrete jungles, but the reality is the cities here in Canada and in the US, there's immense biodiversity, especially if you're looking at insects. In the city of Toronto alone, we have over 300 species. The greater Toronto area, we have over 300 species of wild bees. In Canada, we have over 865 species
wow.
of wild bees.
That's amazing.
So, yeah. And all you have to do is start looking and you'll start seeing them. And many of our wild bees are green and blue and silver. They're not what we're sort of trained to think about with the yellow and black striped honeybee. So yeah, we have immense biodiversity, and cities can provide a little bit of shelter for some of the things that climate change might cause. For example, if there's a drought, people will maybe water their plants. If there's an ice storm and, you know, trees fall down, they are often replanted. But there's a lot of ways that cities, especially like Toronto with our ravine system that just cuts through the city in so many ways, that we can host a ton of biodiversity. And with more biodiversity, we know that systems are more resilient, because the more species you have in a system, the more resilient that system is. So keeping every single pollinator and native plant there will help us as we deal with climate change going forward.
Let's keep with you for a moment, Sheila. You mentioned so many species of bees. Are honeybees one of them?
So we did a survey, and more than half of Canadians thought that the European honeybee was a native wild species in Canada, and that is not true. It was brought here with settlers, and it continues to be imported and exported all over the place. So if you see a honeybee, chances are there's a beekeeper that's taking care of that honeybee. They're non-native species, and they're not at risk of extinction. They're very common. You can order them. You can have your own hive. Very different than the bees that I study, which are often endangered. None of our native bees in North America actually make honey. All of our bees sleep for the winter, so they do not need to make honey, store honey. And honeybees do, because they stay awake. They're kind of more adapted to Mediterranean type climates.
Okay, I am copying to the fact that I did not know that honeybees were Canadian. But Lorraine, I'm wondering if you can talk to us then about the native bees as pollinators. Why are the relationships between native plants, native to Canada, and pollinators so important?
Well, the whole definition of native plants is, you know, a plant that has co-evolved in an area with all of the other creatures that it has relationships with and has co-evolved with. Some of these relationships are so specific and dependent. You think about the relationship between monarch butterflies and the native plant milkweed, for example. That's a specific relationship, a dependent relationship that a lot of us are very familiar with now. But these sorts of co-evolved specific relationships exist throughout the ecosystems. You can't just substitute other introduced or non-native plants and still be supporting those co-evolved relationships. That's just not the way it works.
It makes sense. I'm listening to you and thinking other listeners are thinking, I really want to try this, but I don't have time. I don't have money to overhaul my entire garden. Or maybe it's the place where their family and friends spend time or where the dog plays. What is one thing that listeners could do this spring to help with biodiversity?
Well, one very meaningful place to start is to think about whether or not you have a lawn. Let's say you've got an area of lawn. Think about, do I actually use all of that space that's currently devoted to the lawn that I have to look after, that I have to maintain? Or is there a section of the lawn, maybe a big section, maybe it's just a small section? It will vary, you know, for everyone. But can you, for example, plant a native shrub instead in an area of the lawn? When you think of all of the flowers that are on one native shrub, it's supporting, you know, it will be supporting all kinds of life just by planting, well, maybe one, ideally more than one, and maybe even then being inspired by that when you see all the birds and butterflies and bees that visit that native shrub. And then you might think, well, maybe I can grow some habitat underneath the shrub and then maybe spreading out even wider. And pretty soon, actually, I think once you start doing this, it's very easy to get hooked because you see the life that you're supporting.
You're really good at selling this, Lorraine. is it another
suggestion I can give as well?
Yeah, Sheila, go ahead.
Don't have if you go to your local park, natural areas, and there's a stewardship group that's pulling invasive plant species. That's another really good way if you don't have your own land to do it, or your own space or time or money to just put in, you know, a couple hours of volunteering, just pulling plants. That's a really excellent way to help native biodiversity as well.
What about the flower planters that you see on city streets, Sheila?
Oh yeah, that's definitely an excellent way. If you lobby your local business improvement association, your city councilor, whoever makes those decisions, and instead of planting, I don't know, pansies and petunias, I don't really know what those colorful plants are, to plant things like milkweed and native wildflowers, you'll get some really cool species just as you're walking along main streets in your city. There is a little bit of pushback. People think it looks a little bit more messy, maybe a little bit less colorful, but in general, I think most people understand what the role is there. And a lot of people take pictures of the butterflies that come to visit, and they seem to do a little bit better, like not being watered as often and that kind of thing as well.
Could I just add something?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah,
go ahead. I love that you guys are just talking to each other. I'm just going to shut up. You guys talk.
No. I think it's really important to stress, and as Sheila talked about with these street planters, for example, I think it's really important to stress that there are all of these other community spaces, public libraries or community centers or seniors centers. This work can be done and needs to be done everywhere, and community projects, there's so much energy around doing this with other people. It's such a positive way to build community, you know, human community along with ecological community.
Lorraine, and I have a picture in our book of someone who built kind of a shelf above their garbage bins and then just planted some native plants in some pots just above their garbage bins, and it looks amazing.
Oh wow, what a way to dress up the garbage.
There are no limits to the creativity that can be brought to this search for places in our communities where we can grow habitat and provide really meaningful habitat for pollinators birds and all creatures.
But I do have one question. I mean, you want to get the native plants. Is it just as simple as going to the garden center and say, give me some native plants, please? Where can people find them?
The best place to find native plants, to purchase native plants, because they should never be dug from the wild. There are gardening groups that will share native plants, which is amazing. And there are seed exchanges where, you know, people will share seeds. So that's one of the most inexpensive ways to do this. But for purchasing plants, the best place to do that is actually from a specialty native plant nursery. And there are specialty native plant nurseries across the country. They're really good resources. There's a website, networkofnature.org, that has a map with all of the native plant nurseries across Canada. And these are amazing sources of information as well. Just to look at online at their websites and see the sorts of plants that they have available. And that's one great way to learn about what plants are native in your particular area.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, can you give us a couple of examples of what plants people can look for in some different parts of Canada?
Yeah, well, some of the most valuable plants in terms of supporting pollinators. So these are sometimes called keystone species. Some of the keystone species across Canada are goldenrods, asters, coneflowers, and sunflowers. And there are native species of each of those across the country. Now, it might vary in your area, but there are also some native plants that are native pretty much across the country, like field pussytoes, pearly everlasting.
Those are great native names.
I know. There are native strawberries that, you know, you can grow as a ground cover. Wild strawberry for sun, there's woodland strawberry for shade, and this will be a great ground cover that will also provide food for humans, food for birds in those delicious little berries.
I was going to say all the berry plants, really all the native berries, service berry, all the wild blueberries, those are all excellent pollinator plants as well.
Wow. I mean, this has been such a really delightful conversation, but I want to just try something for a little bit of fun before we wrap up. I want to ask each of you, if you haven't done this already, to tell me what your favorite fact is about a native pollinator or plant that brings you the most joy to share with others. Sheila, let's start with you.
I actually wanted to talk a little bit about goldenrod, so I think maybe I'll go here. So it blooms at the same time as ragweed. So a lot of people assume that goldenrods are the reason they're sneezing at the end of the summer. And a reason why I think this is also the case is Sneezy in Snow White is walking around with goldenrod in his hand all the time.
Oh my goodness.
There's been like some inception there from early ages that goldenrod is somehow causing us to sneeze. It is not true. Goldenrod is pollinated by insects. It has heavy pollen that sticks to insect bodies. It's not a wind pollinated plant like trees and grasses are. Some trees, not all trees, but anyway. And yeah, it's such an important plant because it blooms in high abundances at the end of the growing season. So towards the fall in Southern Ontario, you see it, you know, October, even into November sometimes. And that's what monarchs need to make that trip over the Great Lakes. It's what all of our native bees need to build up their fat stores before they start sleeping for the whole summer. It is one of the most critical plants, and so many people don't know how important it is and actually think it's a bad weed. But if you do see it pop up, I encourage you to just let it be, if at all possible.
Okay. Another lesson learned for me. Obviously, you're teaching me a lot here. Lorraine, what about you?
One of the most amazing things I've learned about the relationship between plants and pollinators, I learned from Sheila, who shared some research that colleagues of hers had done around bees self-medicating on native plants.
And
this completely, I just found it incredible, you know, just an example of these, the importance of these co-evolved relationships. When bees are infected with a very common parasite, they will self-medicate in terms of spending longer at flowers that contain a compound that will counteract the parasite.
That is fascinating.
Definitely. Yeah. There's some plants like turtlehead and other plants that have alkaloids and nicotine and caffeine, and that helps bees lower their parasite levels in ways that we're just beginning to understand. And I think that was one of the reasons why Lorraine and I wanted to write this book, because there's a lot of, you know, planting gardens for pollinator type things out there and resources out there, but we wanted to start communicating a little bit more about how complex things were and how much we don't know just yet. and how important it is for us to nurture these relationships that we're still learning about.
This has been such an enjoyable conversation. I've learned so much. I think we probably could go on a lot longer, but we don't have any more time. So I'm going to say goodbye to you for now, and thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Paper or plastic?
Oh, I forgot my own bags. Plastic. No, wait, paper. Hang on, which one's better? I don't know.
Don't stress, Neil. The podcast Living Planet is here to help. We know you want to do what's right for the planet, but you're busy and you have to make 1,000 small decisions every day. So we endeavor to answer, what's better?
Cotton or polyester?
Tea or coffee?
For answers to these environmental conundrums and your questions, subscribe to Living Planet wherever you listen to podcasts.
For our next story, we're heading back to the ocean, and it's for a story about helping baby salmon survive our warming world.
We're in a stream on the coast of Vancouver Island, and the rocks here are slick with this bright green stringy algae. It's really slippery, but I'm not going to fall. There's some Canada geese with their goslings, very cute. And beautiful songbirds in the distance. Oh, and by the way, I'm Molly Siegel. Get your hip waders on and join me as we sploosh through this estuary in search of teeny tiny salmon.
All fish go in the bucket, and then once we put them into our viewers, we'll identify them.
Whoa! Okay, we're all really excited about this find here, and I promise you, if you stay tuned, I will share what we found. Today, we're talking about helping baby salmon survive. Estuaries, where freshwater and saltwater meet, are sort of like a nursery for young salmon. But development, industry, and climate change are raising the stakes here, putting this habitat at high risk. So, we're going to find out how people are trying to change the course of that future for these fish. I meet up with the crew from Simon Fraser University just as they're wrapping up their lunch.
Ben, nice to meet you.
We all kind of look like fly fishers decked out in our hip waders. Ben is a PhD student, Veronica is a research assistant, and Sarah...
I'm just here.
And Sarah's just my friend.
And the one introducing Sarah...
Okay, sure. I'm Phoebe Gross. I'm a second-year master's student in the Salmon Watersheds Lab at Simon Fraser University, and I'm working on climate change impacts on juvenile salmon. And today, we're doing work in the Englishman River estuary.
We're on the east coast of Vancouver Island in the city of Parksville.
It's a nice sunny day. It's a bit windy. It's about mid-afternoon, and we're about halfway through our workday, so we're going out to a few more sites.
The tide is their clock, so we need to get moving before their research site is submerged again. We walk over rocks and these small, thin, green succulents.
That is sea asparagus. You can actually eat that.
Oh, fun.
The site is, it's just right up here by that fallen log.
We reach a muddy, rocky bank on an offshoot of the Englishman River. It's not too far from where it meets the Pacific Ocean. There's an RV resort, and I can see why you'd want to vacation here. It's idyllic with the mountain peaks across the ocean. But this waterfront view is rapidly changing with human-caused global warming.
Sea level rise is going to drive shifts in a number of really important things for salmon.
Important things, including estuaries like this one. Rising seas will push these nurseries further inland. The problem is, though, people have developed some of those places. We have roads and concrete, buildings and oceanfront views. We talk a lot on this show about how people are moving away from changing shorelines. But what about salmon? That's what sets this work apart, and honestly what caught my attention. Often, restoring salmon habitat focuses on the present day. But this work asks, where are the estuaries likely to be in the future? And how can we start to protect those spaces for baby salmon? To answer that, Phoebe needs more information about where the fish live today. For a few years now, researchers at Simon Fraser University have been collecting data at 8 estuaries across Vancouver Island. And Phoebe has it down to a routine.
Yeah, so the first thing we do is set up our buckets. We'll fill them with water.
Is this a bubble machine?
Yeah, it's just to oxygenate the water so the fish don't suffocate in there.
Right.
Okay, it's time to catch some of the small fish living here. The group unfurls a net attached to two poles, which are so tall, taller than the average person.
Lift it up a little bit more. One more time. Can be fine now.
Then two people wade into the water. They create a loop, walking the two ends of the net together to catch the small salmon. They reel them in.
So now that you've corralled everything in here, what are you doing right now?
We're scooping them into one of our buckets with the bubbler so that we can count and measure all of them.
Not just how big or how small they are, but also what kind of fish they are.
All fish go in the bucket, and then once we put them into our viewers, we'll identify them.
Whoa!
So this is a super...
Super
I think
lively.
That's, yeah, so that was still, I believe, a sculpin, right?
Like a very lime green color.
Surprises like this small, vibrant lime green sculpin punctuate what's otherwise a bit of a repetitive series of tasks.
Yeah, so now that we've scooped them into the bucket, Sarah's getting our fish viewers that have rulers in them.
And the tally begins.
Spooky 45. A stickleback.
Oh, you just called them stickies.
Yeah. Stickleback 47 and 63.
6.5 for another stickleback.
Okay, you get the idea.
And a sticky.
But there's a flatfish there.
But the stars of the show elude us.
6 stickleback?
We catch no salmon. No coho, no chum, no chinook, no pink or sockeye.
Yeah, I think we're good to dump.
All right. Okay. Strain time.
They also measure the water itself.
Don't go past
its temperature, how salty it is, how much oxygen is in it, and how acidic it is. Because all of those things help tell a story about where good salmon habitat is. Then they want to know what's kicking around that a small salmon would want to eat. Things like plankton and invertebrates. They start with a cone-shaped net, attached to a rope so they can skim it across the surface of the water. Sarah reels in the rope.
This is the sound of science.
And one more net to get a sample deeper in the water.
Together, this is hopefully helping us understand the prey that's available for juvenile salmon.
Phoebe's days in the field bring her to different sites across Vancouver Island. But they all have this kind of rhythm. Catch and count the fish.
Goby at 47.
Measure the water quality.
19.7.
Then find out what's on the menu.
Like aquatic roly-polies.
Sweet.
I don't know.
And on to the next site.
So yeah, that's it for the day.
With the odd interruption along the way, like that crow. And yes, that is a crow. Anyways, they go from site to site until they gather enough data to start painting a picture. After a day of waiting and counting and collecting, Phoebe and I drive down a residential street to the head of the estuary. A spit of infill land sort of juts out from the end of the road. There actually used to be an art gallery here.
Right now we're at the end of this piece of land that the restoration is happening.
Now restoration is in progress. The building has been torn down. Eventually, at this site, the concrete and reinforced shoreline will also be dismantled, and plants that grow in the estuary will be replanted. And all of those things will help the young salmon. Both today and as sea level rise pushes their nursery habitat closer and closer to the concrete.
We're looking right at the mouth of the estuary, so to our right is the coastline and the ocean, and then looking into the left, we have most of the estuary.
And on the other side of the mouth, there's the RV resort I mentioned earlier. This view here is kind of the front lines of sea level rise.
It's like within like a meter or two by the end of the century.
But then what does that translate to in terms of, like, what kind of stuff is going to be underwater, likely based on the projection?
The trailer park will likely be partly underwater, at least, and a number of these houses along the coastline will probably be partly inundated.
Everything will move further inland, the trees, then the marsh, and then the beach itself. At least that's how it works in theory. But there's a caveat to this.
We have all of these houses on one side and this trailer park on the other side. So if they're there and they're not moving and the estuary is moving in, the estuary has nowhere to go and it'll eventually get drowned out. And that's kind of a process that's referred to as coastal squeeze.
And eventually
lose the estuary and you lose that important nursery area for salmon.
Yeah, exactly.
The work Phoebe and the Salmon Watersheds Lab are doing will create a future map for salmon nurseries on Vancouver Island. And by predicting where on land these little fish may need to be, other groups can use this science to make decisions about what to protect or restore.
Are we investing in something that, you know, is going to exist in 100 years with sea level rise and climate change? My name's Steve Henstra. I'm a restoration biologist working for the Nature Trust of British Columbia.
He works with other conservation groups and the federal government, restoring estuaries, including this one. I meet Steve on a popular walking path nearby.
This path we're standing on now, the Mine Dyke Road, was actually built as a log booming road out to the spit. So they used to boom logs from forestry there and then drag it out of the bay of the estuary at high tide. So
that was in the 1960s. A berm built at that time was blocking the natural flow of tides. So in 2017, the Nature Trust of BC took it out as part of restoration, allowing the tides back in, which helps create the conditions that estuary plants need to thrive. But restoring existing habitat is one thing. Steve also wonders about what actions will make the most difference in the future.
Your dollars are better spent, like, future-proofing that estuary, so to speak, where you're focusing on adjacent upland land acquisition.
In other words, should restoration and protection be focused on the places these estuaries are moving towards as the sea level rises? Estuaries make up just 3% of the coastline, but they're crucial habitat for so many animals, including salmon. And salmon and people have a very long history on Vancouver Island, one that goes back long before colonization. The researchers at Simon Fraser University partner with First Nations at each of their sites. And here on Nanoose First Nation traditional territory, Chris Bob, who is a counselor with the nation, describes the importance of this place.
The reason our village was there is because it was right beside Qualloch, or the Englishman River, and that word means dog salmon. You know, that's what got our people through the winters. We would process that, we would smoke that fish, we would store that fish, we would trade that fish, but it would provide for us through all those winters, all those generations. We have, you know, archaeological proof showing our occupancy for thousands of years. And Canada's been here for, what, 150? And nosedive industries.
Industries like forestry and fishing.
Our wealth is being damaged and taken away. And the thing is, we do the best we can to protect what we have left, you know, and we try to ensure, you know, that resource is going to be there for our future generations.
Oh my gosh, you just did that. I couldn't pull it out.
Oh, well, I just...
The next morning, I meet a group of volunteers who are getting to work near the estuary.
Okay, this is the spotted knapweed, which hasn't bloomed yet, Yana, and that's the bloom. I found one down here, as I mentioned in my email. I'm Dave Hutchings. I'm the stewardship coordinator for the Arrowsmith Naturalists, and we've been working down here on the Englishman River estuary, basically with the Nature Trust to try and reduce the number and control the spread of invasive plants on the estuary. There's a lot of them are very small, like this as well.
Dave and I chat as we walk on a trail towards the water.
The estuary is a living organism, basically. And it will change. Not only does the river flow change, but the direction of the river changes. And of course, with sea level rise, that's going to change the whole hydrology of the area as well.
So what Dave and the other naturalists are doing is trying to keep the current estuary habitat healthy by pulling out invasive species that actually make it difficult for the native ones to survive.
Basically, since colonization, the estuary has been transformed by white settlers into a number of uses. It's been used as farming, so there's been a lot of ditching, there's been a lot of diking on the estuary.
Then the logging, and the development, and the art gallery. Of all the places Phoebe and the rest of the Simon Fraser University team study, this one is one of the most heavily altered. It's day two of our field visit, and Phoebe leads the way to a different offshoot of the Englishman River.
This part we're standing on will probably all be flooded at high tide.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. So you got to get to work.
Exactly.
The ocean seems a bit far away this time. On one bank, there's a meadow, and on the other, there's trees and bushes. The river is full of bright green algae.
Where we suspect there might be some salmon. So I'm just in about, 20 centimeters of water. It's pretty shallow.
Yesterday, the crew actually didn't find a whole lot of salmon.
Lots of vegetation.
But reeling in the same net here.
It's our salmon.
There he is.
We already seem to be having a bit more luck.
Oh, he is a salmon?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
The count begins.
Coho 53 and 41.
Maybe 12. Oh, there's some flatfish in there.
Oh, yeah. Really?
We only have 7 salmon.
Oh, and all coho?
Yep, all coho. In previous years, we've got over 100 here.
Oh.
Yeah.
But I guess previously it hasn't been as hot at this time of year is one difference.
Yeah, last year it was a lot cooler and the water was not as low. So I think that's making a pretty big difference this summer.
All of these observations help Phoebe and others figure out what salmon need to survive climate change into the future.
Seeing where in the estuary these pockets of colder temperatures might be, which will be super important as temperatures continue to rise and reach these stressful and lethal levels for juvenile salmon.
Thanks for that, Molly. There is a little update to share since we first brought you that story last July. The project this work is part of, Enhancing Estuary Resilience in Coastal BC, was recognized by the United Nations. UNESCO endorsed the project as a contribution to the UN Decade of Ocean Science for Sustainable Development. And between Molly's story and the one I did on clam gardens, you certainly can get a sense of what is at stake here for people and the sense that what really is needed is ways to allow for water to stay cooler, to allow species to not only survive and thrive. Now, coming up next week, we're going to take you to the Northeast Swale in Saskatoon. It's a field of grasslands mixed with wetlands that's important not only because of its biodiversity, but also because the landscape can store carbon.
That's the amazing thing about grasslands. Some people have likened them to upside-down tropical forests. We all know that the forests of the Amazon, for example, and forests in general, are really important for the way they hold carbon. But grasslands, prairies, are amazing for their ability because they put it in the ground. So the plants themselves, the above-ground parts of the plants aren't perhaps very impressive to some eyes, but they have such deep roots and they put all their energy into those roots. And that material stores carbon. So grasslands as a whole they're like this storage reservoir that's half full. And so they're a remarkable resource for us. If we restore, if we protect the surviving fragments of natural grassland, and if we restore grasslands, put more land back into permanent culture, especially with a diversity of species, then we can store carbon underground.
We'll hear more about preserving grasslands and how that can help the climate on our show next week. That's with guest host Leisha Grabinski in Saskatoon. Remember, you can listen to all of our episodes on demand at CBC Listen, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, you can leave us a review. That's all for us this week. The What on Earth team is Danielle Piper, Vivian Luck, Rachel Sanders, Molly Siegel, Matthias Wolfson, and Catherine Rolfson. I'm Laura Lynch. Thank you for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.